Practice Test 2. This is the Cambridge English C1 Business Hire Listening Test 2. You will hear an introduction to each part of the test, and you will have time to look at the questions before you listen. You will hear each piece twice. While you are listening, you should write your answers on the question paper. There will now be a pause. Please ask any questions now, because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. Part one, questions 1 to 12. You will hear a training centre owner talking to employees about the company's recent performance and outlook. Write 1 to 3 words or a number in the numbered spaces on the notes or forms below. You will hear the recording twice. Now listen and complete the notes.
Hi everyone, thanks for arriving on time. As I'm sure you've all noticed, over the last few months we've seen a decline in business. Until April of this year, we were doing well. We had more clients than at the same time last year, and overall profits were up by 6%. Since then, however, business has been slow and getting slower. I wanted to talk to you about why this has been happening and what we're planning to do about it. I think there are several reasons why we've seen this decline. Firstly, late last year, the government announced that it would end a tax break on educational training. Before, individuals and companies could sign up for the kind of training we offer, and the amount they paid would be taken off their taxable income. Under the government's new policy, however, they can only deduct a quarter of the cost of training. Unfortunately, we're definitely seeing the effects of that now. Secondly, the national economy is slowing down, and as a general rule, people tend to spend less on training when there's a recession. A couple of competitors have also started doing business nearby. One of them is not doing very well at all, I hear, and isn't much of a threat to us. But the other one has definitely taken some of our clients. They did that by offering very aggressive pricing. I initially chose not to compete with them on price because we're known for our quality. But with hindsight, that might have been a mistake. Anyway, although business is down, there are no plans for any layoffs. So if you were worried about losing your job, relax. One reason is that we've recently partnered with a local private language school to offer training services to their clients. It's a really interesting partnership that has the potential to generate a lot of revenue. And if it works with this one private school, I know of at least two others that are interested. After this meeting, I'll be speaking to 3 or 4 of you who I want to help this get off to a really strong start. In addition to that partnership plan, we're going to be a lot more aggressive in the way we try to attract clients. One thing we'll do is start up a marketing campaign to try and persuade people that a recession is actually the time when they should be investing in training. We'll also be offering better value, but not in the form of discounted prices. Instead, for every 10 training sessions the client books, we'll give that client one free training session. In other words, clients will be getting the equivalent of 10% of their training sessions for free. This is great for clients, and because we're almost always under capacity, it won't add to our costs, so it's good for us too. I hope that's all clear. Any questions?
Now you will hear the recording again.
Hi everyone, thanks for arriving on time. As I'm sure you've all noticed, over the last few months we've seen a decline in business. Until April of this year, we were doing well. We had more clients than at the same time last year, and overall profits were up by 6%. Since then, however, business has been slow and getting slower. I wanted to talk to you about why this has been happening and what we're planning to do about it. I think there are several reasons why we've seen this decline. Firstly, late last year, the government announced that it would end a tax break on educational training. Before, individuals and companies could sign up for the kind of training we offer, and the amount they paid would be taken off their taxable income. Under the government's new policy, however, they can only deduct a quarter of the cost of training. Unfortunately, we're definitely seeing the effects of that now. Secondly, the national economy is slowing down, and as a general rule, people tend to spend less on training when there's a recession. A couple of competitors have also started doing business nearby. One of them is not doing very well at all, I hear, and isn't much of a threat to us. But the other one has definitely taken some of our clients. They did that by offering very aggressive pricing. I initially chose not to compete with them on price because we're known for our quality. But with hindsight, that might have been a mistake. Anyway, although business is down, there are no plans for any layoffs. So if you were worried about losing your job, relax. One reason is that we've recently partnered with a local private language school to offer training services to their clients. It's a really interesting partnership that has the potential to generate a lot of revenue. And if it works with this one private school, I know of at least two others that are interested. After this meeting, I'll be speaking to three or four of you who I want to help this get off to a really strong start. In addition to that partnership plan, we're going to be a lot more aggressive in the way we try to attract clients. One thing we'll do is start up a marketing campaign to try and persuade people that a recession is actually the time when they should be investing in training. We'll also be offering better value, but not in the form of discounted prices. Instead, for every 10 training sessions the client books, we'll give that client one free training session. In other words, clients will be getting the equivalent of 10% of their training sessions for free. This is great for clients, and because we're almost always under capacity, it won't add to our costs, so it's good for us too. I hope that's all clear. Any questions?
That is the end of part one. You now have 20 seconds to check your answers. Part 2, questions 13 to 22. You will hear five people talking about how they got their current job and how the job has changed since they started it. For each recording, there are two tasks. Look at task 1. For each question 13 to 17, choose how each person got their job from the list A to H. Now look at task 2. For each question 18 to 22, match the speaker with the way the job has changed from the list A to H. Do not use any letter more than once. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 30 seconds to read the two lists. Now listen and do the two tasks. Speaker 1.
My job has changed in so many ways since I got it that it's almost a completely different profession. Computers have made certain things much easier, and some things that would previously have taken weeks or even been impossible can now be done in just a few minutes, if you know what you're doing, that is. I still love my work, but sometimes I miss the old days when we had to do everything by hand. My uncle, who was the person who got me into this field originally, still works in the old way, in fact. He says it gives his work a certain character that you can't get with modern techniques. And given that he's busier than ever, I guess a lot of his clients agree.
Speaker 2.
When I was a child, I loved reading, and some of my favourite books were about doctors and nurses. So I was already predisposed to think about a career in medicine, I think. Still, I might have made a different choice if it wasn't for the accident. I don't remember much about the actual moment when the car hit me, but I do remember every day in the hospital afterwards and how amazing the people who cared for me were. I realised pretty soon that this was what I wanted to do with my life. One interesting thing is that in those days, the doctors were almost all men, but almost none of the nurses were. I'm glad that it's not like that now.
Speaker 3. I needed some money as a student and got a part-time position at a little cafe near my university. At first, I was just washing up and occasionally waiting tables. Then, one day, one of the cooks called in sick. There was nobody to cover for her, so I stepped in. I thought I was going to be a disaster, to be honest, but I had some compliments from customers which gave me confidence. Over time, I was in the kitchen more and more, and before I knew it, it had become my career. It's funny, though, looking back at my early days. Back then, we only offered traditional food from this country. Now, everything on the menu is a fusion dish inspired by this cuisine or that. I like the traditional stuff personally, but customers have become more adventurous over the years. Speaker 4.
I was a teacher for years. One day, a woman who worked for the company that published the main textbook I used came to my school. Now, I liked the book, but it had a lot of mistakes, and I mentioned this. Her response was a bit rude, to be honest. She just told me, "If you think you can do better, go ahead," or words to that effect. I'm sure she didn't expect me to do it, but the idea intrigued me, and I spent a year writing the book I wanted to use. My colleagues all loved it, and soon enough I had a publishing deal and was making enough money to quit as a teacher. I was lucky. Publishers were much more open to working with people who weren't already big names when I got into the field. These days, if you aren't already well known, forget it.
Speaker 5.
By the time I was 25, I'd already had 8 jobs across 5 different industries. I didn't know what I wanted to do, what my skills were, what I liked. Nothing, really. A good friend suggested a book that would help me get a handle on my life. I didn't expect much, to be frank. I mean, we might hear, "This book will change your life," but we know it's just advertising, right? Well, for me, it really was true. It's not like I knew exactly what to do with my life after finishing the last page, but I knew how to find out, and that was what made the difference. So, although some people think working as a programmer must be boring, it's actually my dream job. Not least because there are always new things to learn, new skills to acquire, and new techniques to master.
Now you will hear the recording again. Speaker 1.
My job has changed in so many ways since I got it that it's almost a completely different profession. Computers have made certain things much easier, and some things that would previously have taken weeks or even been impossible can now be done in just a few minutes, if you know what you're doing, that is. I still love my work, but sometimes I miss the old days when we had to do everything by hand. My uncle, who was the person who got me into this field originally, still works in the old way, in fact. He says it gives his work a certain character that you can't get with modern techniques. And given that he's busier than ever, I guess a lot of his clients agree.
Speaker 2.
When I was a child, I loved reading, and some of my favourite books were about doctors and nurses. So I was already predisposed to think about a career in medicine, I think. Still, I might have made a different choice if it wasn't for the accident. I don't remember much about the actual moment when the car hit me, but I do remember every day in the hospital afterwards and how amazing the people who cared for me were. I realised pretty soon that this was what I wanted to do with my life. One interesting thing is that in those days, the doctors were almost all men, but almost none of the nurses were. I'm glad that it's not like that now.
Speaker 3. I needed some money as a student and got a part-time position at a little cafe near my university. At first, I was just washing up and occasionally waiting tables. Then, one day, one of the cooks called in sick. There was nobody to cover for her, so I stepped in. I thought I was going to be a disaster, to be honest, but I had some compliments from customers which gave me confidence. Over time, I was in the kitchen more and more, and before I knew it, it had become my career. It's funny, though, looking back at my early days. Back then, we only offered traditional food from this country. Now, everything on the menu is a fusion dish inspired by this cuisine or that. I like the traditional stuff personally, but customers have become more adventurous over the years. Speaker 4.
I was a teacher for years. One day, a woman who worked for the company that published the main textbook I used came to my school. Now, I liked the book, but it had a lot of mistakes, and I mentioned this. Her response was a bit rude, to be honest. She just told me, "If you think you can do better, go ahead," or words to that effect. I'm sure she didn't expect me to do it, but the idea intrigued me, and I spent a year writing the book I wanted to use. My colleagues all loved it, and soon enough I had a publishing deal and was making enough money to quit as a teacher. I was lucky. Publishers were much more open to working with people who weren't already big names when I got into the field. These days, if you aren't already well known, forget it.
Speaker 5.
By the time I was 25, I'd already had 8 jobs across 5 different industries. I didn't know what I wanted to do, what my skills were, what I liked. Nothing, really. A good friend suggested a book that would help me get a handle on my life. I didn't expect much, to be frank. I mean, we might hear, "This book will change your life," but we know it's just advertising, right? Well, for me, it really was true. It's not like I knew exactly what to do with my life after finishing the last page, but I knew how to find out. And that was what made the difference. So, although some people think working as a programmer must be boring, it's actually my dream job. Not least because there are always new things to learn, new skills to acquire, and new techniques to master.
That is the end of part 2. Part 3. Questions 23 to 30. You will hear two founders of a company, Jen Robinson and Daniel Levy, take part in a discussion during a business conference. For each question 23 to 30, mark one letter, A, B or C, for the correct answer. You will hear the recording twice. You have 45 seconds to read through the questions. Now listen and mark A, B or C. Okay, it's now my pleasure to introduce Jen Robinson and Daniel Levy, who jointly founded their flower delivery business, Blooming Great. Welcome both.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, absolutely.
As you both know, our audience submitted some questions ahead of time. The first question is, what was your inspiration for starting your business?
It was Daniel's idea, so I'll let him explain.
About 5 years ago, I had a crazy week. My sister got a new job, my mum had her 60th birthday, a good friend gave birth, and I needed to apologise to my wife for something. Anyway, I decided to send flowers to all of them. I was away on a business trip at the time, so I went online. The ordering process was smooth and easy, but that was the only good thing about the experience. My sister's flowers arrived 3 days after she was supposed to get them, and half of the flowers were dead or dying. My mum's flowers arrived on time, but I'd ordered yellow roses, her favourite, and she received pink ones. The flowers for my friend, the one who'd had the baby, were delivered to completely the wrong address. Twice. And as for the flowers for my wife, well, they never arrived at all. After having had 4 bad experiences in the same week, I was sure I could do better. So I talked to Jen. We'd been friends since doing an MBA together. And we quickly worked up a business plan.
What has been the biggest challenge you've faced so far, then?
We'd both launched companies before, so we had a good sense of what needed doing. And we had startup capital, primarily money that the two of us put in, plus a little more from so-called love investors, like family and friends, and a small, very small, bank loan. So those aspects of the business were on a solid footing. Neither of us knew anything about flowers, though, so there was a steep learning curve there. And although we had a basic idea of the logistics and infrastructure needed to make deliveries, there was an awful lot we didn't know.
Right. I'd say it took us 2-3 years to really get a handle on those aspects of the business, and we're still learning all the time.
A question that several people in the audience would like to know is, what has been your worst experience since you founded the business?
I would say that the last 3 Valentine's days have all been equally bad, albeit in different ways. 3 years ago, we were feeling pretty good about the business. We'd had our first profitable year. The actual profit we made was tiny, but it was a profit. And we were feeling confident that we were going to have even more success. Now, in the flower delivery industry, Valentine's Day is one of the big ones, so it was really important for us. We hired some extra staff to cope with the expected demand and invested heavily in what we thought would be enough flowers for all the orders we were expecting. And then
we got hardly any orders at all. Actually, I'm exaggerating, but we got maybe a third of the orders we were expecting. So it was very, very bad for us. All the extra staff we'd hired and flowers we'd ordered had to be paid for, meaning we barely generated any money. It was very disheartening to know that a single bad day in February was probably going to affect our profitability for the entire year.
Right. So the next year we were determined to get a lot of orders. We put on a huge campaign offering discounted prices, and the orders flooded in, but just never stopped. In the end, there were so many orders that we had to pay other companies to fulfil them for us. That massively cut into our profits, so we were faced with a situation in which a single bad day affected the whole year yet again.
So last year, we were determined to get it right. We had enough orders, we had enough flowers, we had enough staff. We made sure everything was perfect, except...
Except we had moved into a new location about a week before Valentine's Day. It's a great location in that it's convenient for transportation, but it's a little smaller than our old space. And when the time came to get all the orders ready for delivery, we found that there wasn't actually enough space to store all the orders. So we had to beg and borrow space from everyone we knew.
Yes, I used my brother-in-law's kitchen to put together hundreds of bunches of flowers and his bathroom to store them in before they went out for delivery. It was incredibly stressful.
In the end, we got it all done, just. And our customers were satisfied. So it was a relief to finally have a good Valentine's Day in terms of profitability. We'd learnt our lesson, so we're expecting a completely smooth Valentine's Day next year.
Perhaps hoping for, rather than expecting.
Jen Robinson and Daniel Levy, thank you for your insights. Now you will hear the recording again. Okay, it's now my pleasure to introduce Jen Robinson and Daniel Levy, who jointly founded their flower delivery business, Blooming Great. Welcome both.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, absolutely.
As you both know, our audience submitted some questions ahead of time. The first question is, what was your inspiration for starting your business?
It was Daniel's idea, so I'll let him explain.
About 5 years ago, I had a crazy week. My sister got a new job, my mum had her 60th birthday, a good friend gave birth, and I needed to apologise to my wife for something. Anyway, I decided to send flowers to all of them. I was away on a business trip at the time, so I went online. The ordering process was smooth and easy. But that was the only good thing about the experience. My sister's flowers arrived 3 days after she was supposed to get them, and half of the flowers were dead or dying. My mum's flowers arrived on time, but I'd ordered yellow roses, her favourite, and she received pink ones. The flowers for my friend, the one who'd had the baby, were delivered to completely the wrong address. Twice. And as for the flowers for my wife, well, they never arrived at all. After having had 4 bad experiences in the same week, I was sure I could do better. So I talked to Jen. We'd been friends since doing an MBA together. And we quickly worked up a business plan.
What has been the biggest challenge you've faced so far then?
We'd both launched companies before, so we had a good sense of what needed doing. And we had startup capital, primarily money that the two of us put in, plus a little more from so-called love investors like family and friends, and a small, very small, bank loan. So those aspects of the business were on a solid footing. Neither of us knew anything about flowers, though. So there was a steep learning curve there. And although we had a basic idea of the logistics and infrastructure needed to make deliveries, there was an awful lot we didn't know.
Right. I'd say it took us 2-3 years to really get a handle on those aspects of the business, and we're still learning all the time.
A question that several people in the audience would like to know is, what has been your worst experience since you founded the business?
I would say that the last three Valentine's Days have all been equally bad, albeit in different ways. 3 years ago, we were feeling pretty good about the business. We'd had our first profitable year. The actual profit we made was tiny, but it was a profit. And we were feeling confident that we were going to have even more success. Now, in the flower delivery industry, Valentine's Day is one of the big ones. So it was really important for us. We hired some extra staff to cope with the expected demand and invested heavily in what we thought would be enough flowers for all the orders we were expecting. And then
we got hardly any orders at all. Actually, I'm exaggerating, but we got maybe a third of the orders we were expecting. So it was very, very bad for us. All the extra staff we'd hired and flowers we'd ordered had to be paid for, meaning we barely generated any money. It was very disheartening to know that a single bad day in February was probably going to affect our profitability for the entire year.
Right. So the next year we were determined to get a lot of orders. We put on a huge campaign offering discounted prices, and the orders flooded in. But just never stopped. In the end, there were so many orders that we had to pay other companies to fulfil them for us. That massively cut into our profits, so we were faced with a situation in which a single bad day affected the whole year yet again.
So last year, we were determined to get it right. We had enough orders, we had enough flowers, we had enough staff, we made sure everything was perfect. Except
we had moved into a new location about a week before Valentine's Day. It's a great location in that it's convenient for transportation, but it's a little smaller than our old space. And when the time came to get all the orders ready for delivery, we found that there wasn't actually enough space to store all the orders. So we had to beg and borrow space from everyone we knew.
Yes. I use my brother-in-law's kitchen to put together hundreds of bunches of flowers and his bathroom to store them in before they went out for delivery. It was incredibly stressful.
In the end, we got it all done, just, and our customers were satisfied. So it was a relief to finally have a good Valentine's Day in terms of profitability. We'd learnt our lesson, so we're expecting a completely smooth Valentine's Day next year.
Perhaps hoping for, rather than expecting.
Jen Robinson and Daniel Levy, thank you for your insights. That is the end of Test 2.